Chapter 24, Early Labors in Oberlin. The students from Lane Seminary came to Oberlin, and the trustees put up a barracks in which they were lodged, and other students thronged to us from every direction. As I was engaged to come, the brethren at Oberlin wrote, requesting me to bring a large tent to hold meetings in, as there was no room in the place large enough to accommodate the people. I made this request known to some of my brethren, who told me to go and get a tent made, and they would furnish the money. I went and engaged the tent, and they handed me the money to pay for it. It was a circular tent, 100 feet in diameter, furnished with all the equipments for putting it up. At the top of the center pole, which supported the tent, was a streamer, upon which was written in very large characters, "Holiness to the Lord." This tent was of great service to us. When the weather would permit, we spread it upon the square every Sabbath and held public services in it, and several of our earliest commencements were held in it. It was used to some extent also for holding protracted meetings in the region round about, where there were no churches large enough to meet the necessities. I have spoken of the promise of Arthur Tappan to supply us with funds to the extent of his whole income till we were beyond pecuniary want. Upon this understanding with him, I entered upon the work. But it was farther understood between us that his pledge should not be known to the trustees, lest they should fail to make due efforts, as he desired, not merely to collect funds, but to make the wants and objects of the institution known throughout the land. In accordance with this understanding, the work here was pushed as fast as it could well be, considering that we were in the heart of a great forest, and in a location that at the time in many respects was undesirable. We had only fairly entered upon the work of putting up our buildings and had engaged to need a large amount of money when the great commercial crash prostrated Mr. Tappan and nearly all the men who had subscribed for the fund for the support of the faculty. The commercial crash went over the country and prostrated the great mass of wealthy men. It left us not only without funds for the support of the faculty, but $30,000 in debt, without any prospect that we could see of obtaining funds from the friends of the college in this country. Mr. Tappan wrote me at this time, acknowledging expressly the promise that he had made me, and expressing the deepest regret that he was prostrated and wholly unable to fulfill his pledge. Our necessities were then great, and to human view it would seem that the college must be a failure. The great mass of the people of Ohio were utterly opposed to our enterprise, because of its abolition character. The towns around us were hostile to our movement, and in some places threats were made to come and tear down our buildings. A democratic legislature was in the meantime endeavoring to get some hold of us that would enable them to abrogate our charter. In this state of things there was, of course, a great crying to God among the people here. In the meantime, my revival lectures had been very extensively circulated in England, and we were aware that the British public would strongly sympathize with us if they knew our objects, our prospects, and our condition. We therefore sent an agency to England composed of Reverend John Keep and Mr. William Dawes, having obtained for them letters of recommendation and expressions of confidence in our enterprise from some of the leading anti-slavery men of the country. They went to England and laid our objects and our wants before the British public. They generously responded and gave us £6,000. This very nearly canceled our indebtedness. Our friends scattered throughout the northern states, who were abolitionists and friends of revivals, generously aided us to the extent of their ability. But we had to struggle with poverty and many trials for a course of years. Sometimes we did not know from day to day how we were to be provided for, but with the blessing of God we helped ourselves as best we could. At one time I saw no means of providing for my family through the winter. Thanksgiving Day came and found us so poor that I had been obliged to sell my traveling trunk, which I had used in my evangelistic labors, to supply the place of a cow which I had lost. I rose on the morning of Thanksgiving and spread our necessities before the Lord. I finally concluded by saying that if help did not come, I should assume that it was best that it should not, and would be entirely satisfied with any course that the Lord would see it wise to take. I went and preached and enjoyed my own preaching as well, I think, as I ever did. I had a blessed day to my own soul, and I could see that the people enjoyed it exceedingly. After the meeting, I was a little detained in a little conversation with some brethren, and my wife returned home. When I reached the gate, she was standing at in the open door with a letter in her hand. As I approached, she smilingly said, "The answer has come, my dear," and handed me the letter containing a check from Mr. Josiah Chapin of Providence for $200. He had been here the previous summer with his wife. I had said nothing about my wants at all, as I never was in the habit of mentioning them to anybody. But in the letter containing the check, he said he had learned that the endowment fund had failed and that I was in want of help. He intimated that I might expect more from time to time. He continued to send me $600 a year for several years, and on this I managed to live. I should have said that, agreeably to my arrangements in New York, I spent my summers at Oberlin and my winters at New York for 2 or 3 years. We had a blessed reviving whenever I returned to preach there. We also had a revival here continually. Very few students came here then without being converted. But my health soon became such that I found I must relinquish one of these fields of labor. But the interests connected with the college seemed to forbid utterly that I should leave it. I therefore took a dismission from my church in New York, and the winter months which I was to have spent in New York, I spent in laboring in various places to promote revivals of religion. The lectures on revivals of religion were preached while I was still pastor of the Presbyterian Church in Chatham Street Chapel. The two following winters I gave lectures to Christians in the Broadway Tabernacle, which were also reported by Mr. Levitt and published in the New York Evangelist. These also have been printed in a volume in this country and in Europe. Those sermons to Christians were very much the result of a searching that was going on in my own mind. I mean that the Spirit of God was showing me many things in regard to the question of sanctification that led me to preach those sermons to Christians. Many Christians regarded those lectures as rather an exhibition of the law than of the gospel, but I did not and do not so regard them. For me, the law and the gospel have but one rule of life, and every violation of the spirit of the law is also a violation of the spirit of the gospel. But I have long been satisfied that the higher forms of Christian experience are attained only as a result of a terrible searching application of God's law to the human conscience and heart. The result of my labors up to that time had shown me more clearly than I had known before the great weakness of Christians, and that the older members of the church as a general thing were making very little progress in grace. I found that they would fall back from a revival state even sooner than young converts. It had been so in the revival in which I myself was converted. I saw clearly that this was owing to their early teaching, that is, to the views which they had been led to entertain when they were young converts. I was also led into a state of great dissatisfaction with my own want of stability in faith and love. To be candid and to tell the truth, I must say, to the praise of God's grace, He did not suffer me to backslide to anything like the same extent to which manifestly many Christians did backslide. But I often felt myself weak in the presence of temptation and needed frequently to hold days of fasting and prayer and to spend much time in overhauling my own religious life in order to retain that communion with God and that hold upon the divine strength that would enable me efficiently to labor for the promotion of revivals of religion. In looking at the state of the Christian church as it had been revealed to me in my revival labors, I was led earnestly to inquire whether there was not something higher and more enduring than the Christian church was aware of, whether there were not promises and means provided in the gospel for the establishment of Christians in altogether a higher form of Christian life. I had known somewhat of the view of sanctification entertained by our Methodist brethren, but as their idea of sanctification seemed to me to relate almost altogether to states of the sensibility, I could not receive their teaching. However, I gave myself earnestly to search the Scriptures and to read whatever came to hand upon the subject until my mind was satisfied that an altogether higher and more stable form of Christian life was attainable and was the privilege of all Christians. This led me to preach in the Broadway Tabernacle 2 sermons on Christian perfection. Those sermons are now included in the volume of lectures preached to Christians. In those sermons, I defined what Christian perfection is and endeavored to show that it is attainable in this life and the sense in which it is attainable. But about this time, the question of Christian perfection in the antinomian sense of the term came to be agitated a good deal at New Haven, at Albany, and somewhat in New York City. I examined these views as published in the periodical entitled The Perfectionist, but I could not accept them. Yet I was satisfied that the doctrine of sanctification in this life, and entire sanctification in the sense that it was the privilege of Christians to live without known sin, was a doctrine taught in the Bible, and that abundant means were provided for the securing of that attainment. The last winter that I spent in New York, the Lord was pleased to visit my soul with a great refreshing. After a season of great searching of heart, He brought me, as He has often done, into a large place, and gave me much of that divine sweetness in my soul of which President Edwards speaks as attained in his own experience. That winter I had a thorough breaking up, so much so that sometimes for a considerable period I could not refrain from loud weeping in view of my own sins and of the love of God in Christ. Such seasons were frequent that winter and resulted in the great renewal of my spiritual strength and enlargement of my views in regard to the privileges of Christians and the abundance of the grace of God. It is well known that my views on the question of sanctification have been the subject of a good deal of criticism. To be faithful to history, I must say some things that I would otherwise pass by in silence. Oberlin College was established by Mr. Shifford very much against the feelings and wishes of the men most concerned in building up Western Reserve College at Hudson. Mr. Shifford once informed me that the principal financial agent of that college asserted to him that he would do all he could to put down this college. As soon as they heard at Hudson that I had received a call to Oberlin as professor of theology, the trustees elected me as professor of pastoral theology and sacred eloquence at Western Reserve College, so that I held two invitations at the same time. I did not, in writing, commit myself to either, but came on to survey the ground and then decide upon the path of duty. That spring, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church held their meeting at Pittsburgh. When I arrived at Cleveland, I was informed that two of the professors from Hudson had been waiting at Cleveland for my arrival, designing to have me go first, at any rate, to Hudson. But I had been delayed on Lake Erie by adverse winds, and the brethren who had been waiting for me at Cleveland had gone to be at the opening of the General Assembly, and had left word with a brother to see me immediately on arrival, and by all means to get me to go to Hudson. But in Cleveland I found a letter awaiting me from Arthur Tappan of New York. He had in some way become acquainted with the fact that strong efforts were being made to induce me to go to Hudson rather than to Oberlin. The college at Hudson at that time had its buildings and apparatus, reputation and influence, and was already an established college. Oberlin had nothing. It had no permanent buildings and was composed of a little colony settled in the woods and just beginning to put up their own houses and clear away the immense forest and make a place for a college. It had, to be sure, its charter and perhaps 100 students on the ground, but everything was still to be done. This letter of Brother Tappan was written to put me on my guard against supposing that I could be instrumental in securing at Hudson what we desired to secure at Oberlin. I left my family at Cleveland, hired a horse and buggy, and came out to Oberlin without going to Hudson. I thought at least that I would see Oberlin first. When I arrived at Elyria, I found some old acquaintances there whom I had known in central New York. They informed me that the trustees of Western Reserve College thought that if they could secure my presence at Hudson, it would at least, in a great measure, defeat Oberlin, and that at Hudson there was an old school influence of sufficient power to compel me to fall in with their views and course of action. This was in precise accordance with the information which I had received from Mr. Tappan. I came to Oberlin and saw that there was nothing to prevent the building up of a college on the principles that seemed to me not only to lie at the foundation of all success in establishing a college here at the West, but on principles of reform such as I knew were dear to the hearts of those who had undertaken the support and building up of Oberlin College. The brethren that were here on the ground were heartily in favor of building up a school on radical principles of reform. I therefore wrote to the trustees of Hudson, declining to accept their invitation, and took up my abode at Oberlin. I had nothing ill to say of Hudson, and I knew no ill of it. After a year or two, the cry of antinomian perfectionism was heard, and this charge brought against us. Letters were written, and ecclesiastical bodies were visited, and much pains taken to represent our views here as entirely heretical. Such representations were made to ecclesiastical bodies throughout the length and breadth of the land as to lead many of them to pass resolutions warning the churches against the influence of Oberlin theology. There seemed to be a general union of ministerial influence against us. We understood very well here what had set this on foot and by what means all this excitement was raised. But we said nothing. We had no controversy with those brethren that we were aware were taking pains to raise such a powerful public sentiment against us. I may not enter into particulars, but suffice it to say that the weapons that were thus formed against us reacted most disastrously upon those who used them, until at length there was a change of nearly all the members of the Board of Trustees and the faculty at Hudson, and the general management of the college fell into other hands. I scarcely ever heard anything said at Oberlin at that time against Hudson or at any time. We kept about our own business and felt that, in respect to opposition from that quarter, our strength was to sit still, and we were not mistaken. We felt confident that it was not God's plan to suffer such opposition to prevail. I wish to be distinctly understood that I am not at all aware that any of the present leaders and managers of that college have sympathized with what was at that time done, or that they so much as know the course that was taken then. The ministers, far and near, carried their opposition to a great extreme. At that time, a convention was called to meet at Cleveland to consider the subject of Western education and the support of Western colleges. The call had been so worded that we went out from Oberlin expecting to take part in the proceedings of the convention. When we arrived there, we found Dr. Beecher on the ground and soon saw that a course of proceedings was on foot to shut out Oberlin brethren and those that sympathized with Oberlin from the convention. I was therefore not allowed a seat in the convention as a member, yet I attended several of its sessions. I recollect hearing it distinctly said by one of the ministers from the neighborhood who was there that he regarded Oberlin doctrines and influence as worse than those of Roman Catholicism. That speech was a representative one, and seemed to be about the view that was entertained by that body. I do not mean by all of them, by any means. Some who had been educated in theology at Oberlin were so related to the churches and the convention that they were admitted to seats, having come there from different parts of the country. These were very outspoken upon the principles and practices of Oberlin, so far as they were called in question. The object of the convention evidently was to hedge in Oberlin on every side and crush us by a public sentiment that would refuse us all support. But let me be distinctly understood to say that I do not in the least degree blame the members of that convention, or but very few of them, for I knew that they had been misled and were acting under an entire misapprehension of the facts. Dr. Lyman Beecher was the leading spirit in that convention. The policy that we pursued was to let the opposition alone. We kept about our own business and always had as many students as we knew what to do with. Our hands were always full of labor, and we were always greatly encouraged in our efforts. A few years after the meeting of this convention, one of the leading ministers who was there came and spent a day or two at our house. He said to me, among other things, "Brother Finney, Oberlin is to us a great wonder," said he. "I have for many years been connected with a college as one of its professors. College life and principles and the conditions upon which colleges are built up are very familiar to me. I have always thought," said he, "that colleges could not exist unless they were patronized by the ministry. We knew that young men who were about to go to college would generally consult their pastors in regard to what colleges they should select and be guided by their judgment. Now," said he, "the ministers almost universally arrayed themselves against Oberlin. They were deceived by the cry of antimonian perfectionism, and in respect to your views of reform, and ecclesiastical bodies united far and near, congregational and Presbyterian, and of all denominations. They warned their churches against you. They discouraged young men universally from coming to Oberlin, and still the Lord has built you up. You have been supported with funds better than almost any college in the West. You have had by far more students, and the blessing of God has been upon you, so that your success has been wonderful. Now," said he, "this is a perfect anomaly in the history of colleges. The opposers of Oberlin have been confounded, and God has stood by you and sustained you through all this opposition, so that you have hardly felt it. It is difficult now for people to realize the opposition that we met with when we first established this college. As an illustration of it, and as a representative case, I will relate a laughable fact that occurred about the time of which I am speaking. I had occasion to go to Akron to preach on the Sabbath. I went with a horse and buggy. On my way beyond the village of Medina, I observed in the road before me a woman walking with a little bundle in her hand. As I drew near her, I observed that she was an elderly woman, nicely dressed, but walking, as I thought, with some difficulty on account of her age. As I came up to her, I reined up my horse and asked her how far she was going on that road. She told me, and I then asked if she would accept a seat in my buggy and ride. "Oh," she replied, "I should be very thankful for a ride, for I find I have undertaken too long a walk." I helped her into my buggy and drove on. I found her a very intelligent lady and very free and homelike in her conversation. After riding for some distance, she said, "May I ask to whom I am indebted for this ride?" I told her who I was. She then inquired from whence I came. I told her I was from Oberlin. This announcement startled her. She made a motion as if she would sit as far from me as she could, and turning and looking earnestly at me, she said, "From Oberlin? Why," said she, "our minister said he would just as soon send the son to state prison as to Oberlin." Of course, I smiled and soothed the old lady's fears, if she had any, and made her understand that she was in no danger from me. I relate this simply as an illustration of the spirit that prevailed very extensively when this college was first established. Misrepresentations and misapprehensions abounded on every side, and these misapprehensions extended into almost every corner of the United States. However, there was a great number of laymen, and no inconsiderable number of ministers on the whole in different parts of the country who had no confidence in this opposition, who sympathized with our aims, our views, our efforts, and who stood firmly by us thick and thin. And knowing as they did the straitness to which, for the time, we were reduced because of this opposition, they gave their money and influence freely to help us forward. I have spoken of Mr. Chapin of Providence as having for several years sent me $600 a year on which to support my family. When he had done it as long as he thought it his duty, which he did, indeed, until financial difficulties rendered it inconvenient for him longer to do so, Mr. Willard Sears of Boston took his place and for several years suffered me to draw on him for the same amount annually that Mr. Chapin had paid. In the meantime, efforts were consistently made to sustain the other members of the faculty, and by the grace of God, we rode out the gale. After a few years, the panic in a measure subsided. President Mahan, Professor Coles, Professor Morgan, and myself published on the subject of sanctification. We established a periodical, the Oberlin Evangelist, and afterwards the Oberlin Quarterly, in which we disabused the public in great measure in regard to what our real views were. In 1846, I published two volumes on systematic theology, and in this work I discussed the subject of entire sanctification more at large. After this work was published, it was reviewed by a committee of the Presbytery of Troy, New York. Then Dr. Hodge of Princeton published in the Biblical Repertory a lengthy criticism upon my theology. It was from the old school standpoint. Then Dr. Dufield of the New School Presbyterian Church, living in Detroit, reviewed me, professedly from the New School standpoint, though his review was far enough from consistent New Schoolism. To these different reviews, as they appeared, I published replies, and for many years past, so far as I am aware, no disposition has been shown to impugn our orthodoxy. I have thus far narrated the principal facts connected with the establishment and struggles of the school at Oberlin, so far as I have been concerned with them. And being the professor of theology, the theological opposition was directed, of course, principally toward myself, which has led me, of necessity, to speak more freely of my relations to it all than I otherwise should have done. But let me not be misunderstood. I am not contending that the brethren who thus opposed were wicked in their opposition. No doubt the great mass of them were really misled and acted according to their views of right as they then understood it. I must say, for the honor of the grace of God, that none of the opposition that we met with ruffled our spirits here or disturbed us in such a sense as to provoke us into a spirit of controversy or ill feeling. We were well aware of the pains that had been taken to lead these misapprehensions, and could easily understand how it was that we were opposed in the spirit and manner in which we were assailed. During these years of smoke and dust, of misapprehension and opposition from without, the Lord was blessing us richly within. We not only prospered in our own souls here as a church, but we had a continuous revival, or were in what might properly be regarded as a revival state. Our students were converted by scores, and the Lord overshadowed us continually with the cloud of His mercy. Gales of divine influence swept over us from year to year, producing abundantly the fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. I have always attributed our success in this good work entirely to the grace of God. It was no wisdom or goodness of our own that has achieved this success. Nothing but continued divine influence, pervading the community, sustained us under our trials and kept us in an attitude of mind in which we could be efficient in the work we had undertaken. We have always felt that if the Lord withheld His Spirit, no outward circumstances could make us truly prosperous. We have had trials among ourselves. Frequent subjects of public discussion have come up, and we have sometimes spent days, even weeks, in discussing great questions of duty and expediency on which we have not thought alike. But these questions have none of them permanently divided us. Our principle has been to accord to each other the right of private judgment. We have generally come to a substantial agreement on subjects upon which we had differed. And when we have found ourselves unable to see alike, the minority have submitted themselves to the judgment of the majority, and the idea of rending the church to pieces, because in some things we could not see alike, has never been entertained by us. We have to a very great extent preserved the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And perhaps no community has existed for such a length of time and passed through such trials and changes as we have, that has on the whole maintained a greater spirit of harmony, Christian forbearance, and brotherly love. When the question of entire sanctification first came up here for public discussion, and when the subject first attracted the general attention of the church, we were in the midst of a powerful revival. When the revival was going on, hopefully, one day President Mahan had been preaching a searching discourse. I observed in the course of his preaching that he had left one point untouched that appeared to me of great importance in that connection. He would often ask me when he closed his sermon if I had any remarks to make, and thus he did on this occasion. I arose and pressed the point that he had omitted. It was the distinction between desire and will. From the course of thought he had presented, and from the attitude in which I saw that the congregation was at the time, I saw, or thought I saw, that the pressing of that distinction just at that point upon the people would throw much light upon the question whether they really were Christians or not, whether they were really consecrated persons, or whether they merely had desires without being in fact willing to obey God. When this distinction was made clear, just in that connection, I recollect the Holy Spirit fell upon the congregation in a most remarkable manner. A large number of persons dropped down their heads, and some groaned so that they could be heard throughout the house. It cut up the false hopes of deceived professors on every side. Several arose on the spot and said that they had been deceived, and that they could see wherein, and this was carried to such an extent as greatly astonished me, and indeed produced a general feeling of astonishment, I think, in the congregation. The work went on with power, and old professors obtained new hopes, or were reconverted in such numbers that a very great and important change came over the whole community. Professor Mahan had been greatly blessed, among others, with some of our professors. He came manifestly into an entirely new form of Christian experience at that time. In a meeting a few days after this, one of our theological students arose and put the inquiry whether the gospel did not provide for Christians all the conditions of an established faith and hope and love, whether there was not something better and higher than Christians had generally experienced. In short, whether sanctification was not attainable in this life, that is, sanctification in such a sense that Christians could have unbroken peace and not come into condemnation or have the feeling of condemnation or a consciousness of sin. Brother Mahan immediately answered, yes. What occurred at this meeting brought the question of sanctification prominently before us as a practical question. We had no theories on the subject, no philosophy to maintain, but simply took it up as a Bible question. In this form, it existed among us as an experimental truth, which we did not attempt to reduce to a theological formula, nor did we attempt to explain its philosophy until years afterwards. But the discussion of this question was a great blessing to us, and to a great number of our students, who are now scattered in various parts of the country, or have gone abroad as missionaries to different parts of the world.